Thanks, Warren. Thanks for the introduction, although I thought Warren was going to read the bio about my humble beginnings in a log cabin, a dirt floor log cabin in Detroit, and, you know, my very humble beginnings there, but we'll save that for another session. But the Mogi talks I'll be walking you through this afternoon, again, two different aspects. The first one is going to focus on, can we use this national change of address method to reconcile and mitigate some of these Mogis? And then the second talk, I'll actually walk you through the application of that information. So I guess I'm cheating by giving you the heads up that, in fact, we can do something with the data. So I guess, you know, you'll have to stay tuned for the second talk. So so with that said, then, our learning objectives, I like to have learning objectives, for the first talk would be to first review Mogis, the mover gone elsewhere, and implications for immunization registries. We'd like to explore the National Change of Address, or NCOA as I'll refer to it, data as it can mitigate Mogis in an immunization information system. Then finally, explore the potential strategies for adoption by registries. So I'll start out with Mogis defined, and I won't start with the ERA definition, but I like my simple picture. Okay, this is reminder recall in a picture. We start out with, you know, let's see if I can do this. We mail our letters. We expect that the notifications are delivered, and of course, we hope that that will be a cue to action for a parent in most cases to take their child in and be vaccinated. But where the Mogi definition comes in is when we see this, which is all too familiar to you. This one is actually a threefer. Not deliverable to this address, RTS, return to sender, and does not live here. So if you didn't get the message, this is not going to get to who it was going to. So that went back to the Lenawee County Health Department. But we see these by the thousands, and I'm sure you've seen them in your own work. It's at least one flavor of a Mogi. When we look at the formal definition through the American Immunization Registry Association, there are, and I don't want to get into all the little nuances of it, but suffice to say there's at least a couple perspectives you can look at, the private provider perspective or Mogis in the context of a geographic jurisdiction such as a health department. From the perspective of our talk this afternoon, I'm going to be referring to what would be referred to in that document as the inactive Mogi, which is one which has documentation showing that an individual does not reside in that geographic area any longer, and that can be through verbal or postal or other documentation, and in this case we'll use postal documentation. So what are the implications for Mogis? I mean, what's the big deal anyway? Mogi status impact registries in a number of ways, and you know, I think I'm probably preaching to the choir to some degree, but reminder and recalls can't successfully be mailed to a bad address. You know, my simple schematic I just showed you, it's just not going to get there. And that's actually the heart of the mailed reminder and recall, right? It's a cue to action. You get this letter, you say, oh yeah, my kid's overdue for a dose, and then you take him or her in for that dose. It can't happen if we have those bad addresses. The other part, which is near and perhaps not so dear to some of your hearts, is that the vaccination coverage assessment, depending on your jurisdiction, may in fact be affected by the Mogi status, and you might argue is inaccurate. In other words, you may be held responsible for individuals who, at least at one point in time, lived in your jurisdiction, who may no longer live in your jurisdiction, and who may be woefully in need of vaccination. So that brings down your vaccination rate. Needless to say, improving vaccination coverage among a population of individuals that you can't reach is difficult, but it's kind of like, I would say it's more than difficult. And certainly this context may differ from one registry to another. This is more or less the situation in Michigan and perhaps many other jurisdictions, but it can vary. So let's talk a little bit about the United States Postal Service change of address process. So it's a little washed out, but this is a form that maybe you've used more than once yourself. It's a familiar form that your postal carrier can give you if you ask, or you can walk down or go over to the post office and pick one of these up. It's the change of address form. Very simple. What's your name? Where do you live? Where are you going to? It's just that simple. So you submit that information to the Postal Service with an effective date. I should point out that up here it also has a designation. Is this a change for an individual, Jane Doe, or Jane Doe's family? So you can kind of get a collective change of address as well. But that information is submitted to the post office with this date of this effective date, and away you go. So, assuming that individuals file these change of address forms, we can kind of track them through the system, and their mail will catch up to them. And of course, in this day and age, you know, paper's out, right? And you can do it through the web as well. So what happens with that information? Well, you probably know this, but this change of address is submitted, let's say, effective yesterday. And so for the next 12 months, the mail to that new forwarding address that you've put in your change of address form will be forwarded at no charge. So you don't have to stick another stamp on it, and automatically it gets to where it needs to go. It works out very well. Beyond the 12 months, Postal Service kind of puts you on notice. You're on kind of the warning track, so to speak. Well, for 6 more months, they'll return the piece of mail to the sender, but it will have the new address noted on it. So I guess you can update your files and then resend it. Beyond that 18 months, though, it is returned without the new address, with the familiar form or format of the undeliverable notification that we looked at previously. So that's just not going any further. So beyond 18 months, this is pretty much what you end up with. So where does all that information end up when we file these forms? And I should have mentioned at the outset, a little fun fact for you to amaze your friends. About 40 million people move each year in the United States. 40 million people, that's a lot of moving. So that information, now certainly not every person files a change of address, but a lot of them do, as you'll see in a moment. That information goes through this into the Postal Service files, and they have a product which, I mean, if you really want to look into this, you can, you know, bury yourself in detail on the Postal Service website. I'm sure you're going to run off and do that tonight. The National Change of Address Link, brand name, product is their collection of not just the databases, but the software and process which the Postal Service makes available for licensing typically, it's bulk mailing companies that buy these licenses. You and I would not want to do this. It's prohibitive in its expense, but a bulk mailer would buy this license. They get the software. They can either develop their own or lease it from the post office. But the main thing is they have rights to this change of address data. How much data? A lot. That data goes back up to 4 years. So there's a 4-year window of time, which is very important. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But 48 months of data is 160 million records of changes. So it's, let's say, it's not an Excel spreadsheet task. And so it's even the 18-month view is 48 million records. So it's a big stack of data. And again, this is really what these commercial bulk mailing firms typically will do as a service to you and I if we wish to use this. That updated information is delivered by, or provided rather, to the licensees each week through this continuing stream, this incessant stream of change of address forms that are provided to the post office. So with that as a backdrop, that was like the poor man's tour of the change of address process. Let's apply that national change of address to a statewide immunization system just to kind of see how that all works out. So the objective of this study that I'll share with you, and actually both talks kind of orbit around the same basic set of data. Our first objective here is to assess the degree to which updated contact information can be obtained for persons with MOGI status in a statewide immunization information system. We're going to use the United States Postal Service National Change of Address process to do so. So our study design was pretty simple. We collaborated with our friends at the Michigan Department of Community Health and certainly the MICR team, who are instrumental in helping us put together these research projects. We focused, the study I'll be sharing with you this afternoon is focused on kids 19 years and younger with MOGI status in the Micker. We focused on 12 local health department jurisdictions, which actually is 15 counties in southwest Michigan. And those data were identified, or those MOGIs were pulled in August of 2009. So this isn't going to show up quite as well as I wanted it to, but you get the idea. Southwest corner of the state of Michigan, 15 counties, 12 health departments. That's the data that we're providing for you. And I guess for those of you not as familiar with Michigan, you know, we have Kalamazoo, Battle Creek, Kent County includes Grand Rapids, the second largest city in the state of Michigan. So it's a real interesting kind of and diverse, very diverse part of the state, urban and rural, and it certainly is populated. So it's a good laboratory for this sort of experiment. So moving along then, what we did is we had MOGIs with a complete address, and I'll walk you through that in just a moment. Were sent to national change of address to a vendor for two match attempts. Remember when I showed you the form, there's two different types of change of address. There could be one with a parent or the family name, or there could one be one specific to a child. And so we did not want to miss anything, so we actually went through on two sweeps, first for the parent's name, second time around for the ones that didn't match for the child's name. Match cases were evaluated by various characteristics of the child, which I'll share with you in a moment. So let's talk about this matching process for a moment. So this is the nitty-gritty of the NCOA process, is matching. And before you even start out with matching, there's this, you'll get like more terminology than you really want this afternoon. There's this thing referred to as standardization. You have to begin with a standard address, sounds so formal, a standard address to search for matches within the NCOA link. And what that means in really kind of layman's terms is the process is not going to take really a completely junky address and magically fix it. It can do some pretty interesting things, as you'll see in just a moment, but an important fact is it can't take a blank and do something with that, okay? A blank address, you just don't get any traction with that. That goes exactly nowhere, and you'll hear more about that in a moment. So you have to have an address, and it has to be standardized in a fashion that this process can actually do some matching with it. They do actually a really neat and a very intensive process to verify the completeness, accuracy, and validity of those addresses before it can move through this process. And as I mentioned, they do this address standardization, which entails three things. First, an address is compared to a valid range of address numbers that are assigned to that street. So let's say the kid has an address of 123 Main Street. Well, when we send that up to this process, it does a range check to say, okay, well, the maximum value for Main Street in Kalamazoo, Michigan is 500 Main Street, so okay, yeah, that's okay. So it does those sorts of checks. Second, if it's within the correct range, they also have some database, which I think is really kind of interesting, that determines whether it's a valid delivery point. So is it like, you know, an abandoned warehouse or something? You know, so basically they understand certain ranges of addresses on certain streets are basically not deliverable or valid delivery points for mail, which I think is very intriguing. And then finally, you know, with rural routes and people living along county roads and highways and so forth, they have a method for converting that to more of a city-style address, even though that person might be rural route 10 somewhere in Kalamazoo County, they can actually convert that to something that looks a little bit more like a regular address. So that's the standardization process. Before I move on from that, I just want to stress the fact that if your addresses that you're sending to this process can't pass this series of tests, it falls off the wagon, so to speak, and it goes no further, and you'll see that actually happens pretty frequently. So now I'm going to walk you through some of the results from our first our first look at these data. So for standardization, you know, of the kids that we found to be MOGI'd, there was, to start with, there's just over 66,300 of these MOGIs in that southwest corner of Michigan. And just to give you a little bit of context, that's about 9% of the kids, 19 and under, in that area. So about 9% are MOGI'd, which I thought was kind of high. So of that 66%, or excuse me, of that 66,000 MOGIs, 19,600 or 30% could be standardized. So that doesn't mean we found an address. That just means we could actually do something. So I will say that most of the addresses that could not be standardized were null. So they had basically name of kid and nothing else. So as I mentioned, and as you can appreciate, if you have no address, it really doesn't match very well with anything. So that's where most of those mismatches came in, or non-standardizations came into play. Standardization success varied across child characteristics, which I'll just show you a few of them just because I think it's sort of interesting and very telling. So along the x-axis here, I have the age of the child. So this is starting out with our 66,000 MOGIs, and now I'm going to tell you first which ones were able to be standardized. Well, as you can tell, the clear pattern here is that, you know, the younger kids, we have a much higher standardization success. Now, I have to point out, in the folks in the back row, there's probably little chance of you reading this, but some of the sample sizes underneath these bars are rather tiny. For example, we only had 14 kids in the under six months age range who were MOGI'd. There's two stories to this chart. First of all, MOGIs occur more frequently with increasing age. I guess the longer you live, the more likely you are to get MOGI'd, right? I guess that makes sense. But these poor little infants, these little six-month-old infants, you look at that, MOGI'd at 6 months. Well, you know, it's just not a fair life. But these kids, we could at least standardize them, because the younger you are, we have a higher chance of standardizing their address. And as we go on to these older kids, you'll see these really, really large groups of kids, down to 20% for our oldest group. So the older the kid, the more likely that that address was not even something we could send through the process, okay? I will tell you that most of those were nulls. Most of them did not have an address. So a couple quick views here then. That standardization does vary, at least modestly, in some cases dramatically, by certain characteristics. If you look at enrollment in the Medicaid program, if you're enrolled, those kids tended to be able to have a standardized address much more often than the not enrolled kids, and likewise for the WIC enrollees. So there's two things going on here. There's kids who are enrolled in public programs, and there's also an age thing going on, right? The WIC kids are not 19 years old, right? They're five and under. There's an age confounder going on, but I think you get the idea that there is an association there then with these public programs. So I've given you the standardization view. Now those kids, the 19,000 who passed standardization, now we're moving into the final phase of matching. So what can we tell you about that? Well, 15% of those 19,000 standardized addresses could be matched with a forwarding address. I just want to break that out for you. Remember I told you there was two passes to the data? Most of them were matched based on parent name, but we did get another 1% matched based on child name. So we got a little bit there. And if you take that 15% and put it over the denominator of the 66,000 that we started with, that's 5%. So if we kind of hit the pause button for a second here, if you had just a whole bunch of MOGIs in your jurisdiction, you said, okay, I've got these MOGIs, kids are 18 and under, how many of them are likely to be matched from the National Change of Address file? What our experiment has shown, at least thus far, is it'd be about 5%. So that doesn't sound like as stellar as you might have thought, and we'll talk a bit more about that, but it's 5% of those MOGIs, okay? So let's talk about the matching success then. So once again, I've got my age ranges here across the x-axis, and I just want to draw your attention to the same sort of pattern, perhaps not quite as dramatic, but it's the same idea, which is matching, which occurred at a lower level at all ages, did drop off again in these oldest ages, down to 8% for those oldest age groups. So it is definitely, it's kind of the double whammy. You can't standardize as many addresses as you get to the older kids. You can't match as many as you when you get to the older kids. And I guess it is really a triple whammy because there are more of them, and that's kind of really working against you. Okay, a couple other things. I'll show you the Medicaid and WIC effect is there. Not quite as dramatic, but you get the idea that being in Medicaid is more likely to have a match, at least modestly. And then same with the WIC program. We have at least a modest increase in the ability to match amongst those kids who are in WIC. So at this point, I'm going to at least temporarily pause to say, or to share with you at least my conclusions at this point, which are the National Change of Address process can be used to locate forwarding addresses for kids designated as MOGI. The highest degree of matching success is amongst young children, and the least successful is amongst adolescents. But I think it's safe to say, at least based on what we've seen so far, that other strategies to reconcile MOGIs are warranted. So, you know, that 5% I just told you about, I'm not sure I'm ready to kind of bank everything on that 5%, especially amongst adolescents, because the match, at least for the MOGIs, is not as great as I think we might hope for. Now, I do want to do a one-slide diversion to another set of results that will be, I guess it's a commercial or maybe an infomercial for a presentation we'll do tomorrow. But what I just showed you were MOGIs, and as I was saying to Warren ahead of time, it's kind of the worst of the worst with respect to addresses. Some of these kids haven't had their address touched in a decade. I mean, so like they're just really not in good repair, so to speak. So if you were taking a random population of your registry and saying, gee, how many of those could I match against national change of address, it would be a lot better. And I'll show you from some work that we're doing based on other counties, Detroit and Wayne in particular, then also some work we did in Kalamazoo, Kent, and Ottawa counties, which are in this study area, but it was a study from a previous season. But we did a much broader kind of a sampling that was not focused on MOGIs, but kids actually who had high-risk conditions. And what we found were two things, and this is really the point of the slide, that if you have kind of a more of a, let's say, a random population, look at the standardization, 96%. So in this, the MOGI results I just showed you were 30%. So those MOGIs, you can't standardize them. Well, there's so many of those that are null. They're blank. You can't standardize that. Well, this more random sample, 96%. That sounds a little bit better to me. And then matching with a new address, not stellar, but better. So not quite double, but the matching is better as well. So you can standardize more of them and you can match more of them. That's all I want you to take home from this slide, which is the MOGIs are really kind of a tough group to deal with. If you're dealing with a more broad population, it's not quite necessarily that bad. Okay, so now the rhetorical question of the afternoon. And I know you were kind of thinking of this as you came into the room today. Can national change of address solve all of my address problems? Can it? And the answer is, well, maybe not, but it can solve some of them, and I'll walk you through. So let's just, for fun, because this is, I guess, the way I like to have fun, is let's look at this child, a hypothetical child who lived, or at least was born in Kalamazoo County, and she's 8 years old, and she moves a lot. Okay, she actually moves every 2 years. And this is not like totally made up, because just to share another sidebar, some of our other work using these data, we see kids in Medicaid, in the Medicaid address history files with dozens, I mean literally dozens of addresses up until the time they're like a teenager. So I don't think that's really difficult for you to imagine that people change addresses a lot. And then it's kind of the harmonic convergence of like bad stuff. They're hard to find. They're overdue for immunizations, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So these kids move around a lot. So this four moves in 8 years is by no means extreme. So, okay, end of editorial. So child is born in Kalamazoo, lives there for a couple years, moves down the street, is still in Kalamazoo a couple years at that address, moves to a nearby city, Portage, Michigan, lives there for a couple years, and then finally moves to her current address in a another city in Michigan, but a little bit further away. So in these 8 years, this child has moved four times. So this is what you and I secretly know about the life of this child. Now let's look at what NCOA knows about this child, if in fact that parent has submitted the change of address forms along the way. Well, starting out, the National Change of Address knows a file knows where this kid currently lives, because that's where the change of address would point to. But what the change of address file knows really is that child's prior address. So it's really a pointer kind of system that says, I know where you used to be, and I know where you are now. That's all it knows. It does not know the entire history. So even though this kid has moved around a little bit, the change of address file knows 4 years. That's it. And it retains this most previous address. So it's kind of like this moving window. Think of it as a moving window. So we can't look at national change of address as being like, okay, I'm going to go there and get the complete history on this child. Does not work that way. So like, get that out of your mind. So that's the one take home from this slide. So let's say, given that, I say that I've got some MOGIs and I want to match them with the national change of address, just like I did with the numbers I showed you just a few slides ago. Well, so I pulled this kid's record from MICR, and the record, which has been MOGIed, says this kid lives at 501 North Main Street in Kalamazoo. And by the way, this address here is address number 2 of this kid. Well, national change of address database doesn't know that any longer. It retains the most previous address, and the match doesn't occur. So even though we actually had a, quote, valid address, and it could be standardized, it cannot be matched with national change of address because it's too old. So that's a really, really important take home. So I guess if I had to, before I leave this slide, say two things. Standardization, which is really oftentimes impeded by not having an address. If you don't have an address, you can't do anything. This kid has an address, and it doesn't get this child's match doesn't get any further because the address is too old. So what's the implications of all that stuff? Using the change of address process can't resolve all MOGI address issues. I think that's really what I want you to know. This is not the end all and be all. It is a, I think, important, but it's not going to solve all your problems. But I would say that it's probably worthy of consideration as part of a longer-term strategy to improve immunization information system address data. So most MOGIs that can't be used, cannot be used with NCOA are null addresses. That's what we had found. And so either it's blank or the address is written in as unknown or moved or something like that, but it's basically not a real address. Finding an address to attempt the NCOA process may facilitate improved NCOA matches. So what do I mean by that? So let's go back to our little schematic here. Same kid, same history, same everything. If I can't match this kid's current address in MICR because it's too old, maybe, just maybe, if I have access to other information, maybe I can do something like, let's go to the Medicaid history for this kid and find a more recent or current address for that kid and attempt a match there. That serves two purposes. One, if you've got a bunch of those MOGIs for whom you have no address, that's an immediate gain because now we've got something to work with. It may not match, but it's something. A null address does not match, that's for sure, right? So at least I have an address to start the process. So I'm kind of jump-starting things, and now I have an address here that I might be able to get some traction. And so this Medicaid history knows this kid used to live at this address, and lo and behold, that address is within the zone of what NCOA knows in its history. It matches. I can find the kid's current address, and I can send that back to MICR. That's the rub right there, if we can do that. And that, it's not going to work every single time, but it's going to work better than having a blank address, okay? So next steps I'd share with you. We are actually doing that. We're testing that with a variety of information sources, including Michigan Medicaid, the WIC program. We have driver's license data for actually all drivers under the age of 21 for the state of Michigan. And we have Head Start data for three Head Start programs, three counties, as well as a couple of health plans. So we're experimenting with this to actually demonstrate just what kind of traction, so to speak, we can get as a consequence. So I don't have the numbers to share with you now, but we will next time. But you get the idea. That's where this is heading. So before I conclude, I definitely want to acknowledge a wide cast of characters who have helped out in one way, shape, or form with this study. Certainly my colleagues here and back at the University of Michigan, Michigan Department of Community Health, and the MICR folks, as I mentioned, are very instrumental. Detroit, Wayne, Kalamazoo, Kent, and Ottawa County health departments have been very, very cooperative in this and other studies, and certainly the CDC for funding this study. So Warren, I'm going to pause there for first round of questions, and I'm going to drink water while people ask.
Questions for the first Kevin.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. That's real interesting. Had one question. Have you looked at any of this in aggregate, such as for the ones they can correct, you know, to get some idea of how what proportion are moving out of the registry area?
I'm sorry, Steve. Can you
so when you're getting for a MOGI, you're getting anything back? How many of them those addresses are still within your registry catchment versus being able to use that data to estimate what proportion are actually leaving the state and leaving the registry area?
Right. So you know what? That is such a good question, Steve, that I've prepared a second presentation just for you. That's actually what we're going to.
Kevin, too.
You know, I paid him to ask that question. No, actually, that's actually really the focus of the second presentation. And if you don't get your answer, then ask. Okay. Correct. We can come back to the first presentation when you ask those questions then. No, it's. I think we should be able to answer your question then.
Hi, Kevin. Nice presentation. I just have a very practical question. How do we get access to this NCOA database?
Yeah. So what I would suggest is you probably have bulk mailer vendors. Well, they're all over the country. And as I was saying beforehand to some folks, in this day and age of kind of everything is electronic, and we used a Michigan firm, but it's all, you know, FTP, secure FTP up to someplace. They do the match, and the next day the files magically appear. So there are bulk mailing companies all throughout the country that do this service. And I mean, it is something that's out there, like, you know, one web query, and you can find probably more than you can ask for. I can tell you the name of the firm, you know, afterward that we use, but, you know, there are many of them. And it is actually quite a painless process. It's actually very easy.
The cost? What?
Oh, yeah, good question. So cost, it's not that much money. So for the records going in, it varies depending on the size of the file. And again, this is based on one vendor. You probably could strike a better deal somewhere if you really, you know, were working, negotiating a deal. But for a group of about 200,000 records we sent through, the first time around, it was about just shy of a half of a penny, half a cent per record. Okay, so you know it's not nothing, but on the other hand, it's not exorbitant. I'll talk a little bit about strategies in my next talk about like what do you want to do in the long term with that. But the cost is reasonable, I think.
And issues about confidentiality.
See, I don't think, you know, again, that's a state-to-state thing. You know, your attorney general might say, right. Well, you know, this is ridiculous or whatever. You know, how the FERPA interpretation is from one state to the next.
Right.
These are directories of children who are in state programs. There's no HIPAA anything. This, you know, I mean, so it's pretty tame stuff. And it's used routinely by bulk mailers to send you junk mail all the time. So I don't believe that there is any sort of concern, but, you know, in New York, maybe somebody could think of some reason to be concerned. I don't know.
If anywhere in
New York. Or some other jurisdiction, not just New York, Amy. I'm sorry.
Thanks.
All right.
Hi, I'm Jerry Bragg from State of Michigan. A couple of questions. Do you know what, of those that were MOGI'd, what percent didn't get standardized that had an address? Do you know?
That had an address?
That had an address that you had issues standardizing.
I think it's 5%, Jerry, but I can go back and check.
Good. Okay. And let's see, were those, the ones that had blank addresses, did they come up with any type of immunization? Did you pull histories on those to check if they had anything other than the birth those?
Some. But I think, and we can talk more about kind of where these kids come from. I was talking with Warren ahead of time. A lot of them appear to be Well, as I was saying to Warren, it's the chickens coming home to roost. These are kids who probably were the jump start to MICR 10 years ago, who were two or under, who had history that got put into MICR, but maybe not an address.
Oh, so they did have it, so they provided.
They have some, but some of them haven't been touched for 10 years. I mean, some of these kids have like primary vaccination. So here's a 12-year-old girl with, you know, a couple shots from 10 years ago, and that's it, you know? And you'll see in the next a set of results why a lot of those kids may not be in Michigan.
Okay, anymore. So they weren't the students that get MOGI'd by default when the CSRS, when the school data gets entered?
Right. These are a lot of these records are kids who have not had their records touched in a long time.
Okay, yeah, surprised that we had such a high percentage with
yeah.
who weren't the student records. So, okay, thanks.